And we're live. Thank you, everybody, for joining today. Today, we have Thaddeus Russell on the program. Thaddeus is a U.S. historian. He's known for his unconventional views, and he's as showcased in his book, A Renegade History of the United States. Today, as almost all live streams, we're going to talk about Israel and Palestine. Thaddeus actually has some questions for me. I'm going to have some questions for him, so it's just going to be a nice conversation. And obviously, we're going to take some audience questions as well. So chat, let us know where you're tuning in from and let us know what questions you have. Thad, great to have you here. As we agreed, we're actually going to let you take the lead, and you're gonna interview me, and then we'll
flip it around from there. Yeah, let's be clear to the audience. So first of all, is it Adar?
Adar, yeah.
Yeah. I've known a couple wine rubs, by the way. Is that probably the same name originally? Yeah. Spelled rub, R-U-B. So you asked me, just so people know what's going on here, you asked me to be on your live stream a couple days ago. I said, yes, I'd love that. I want to learn things. And you asked me what I wanted to talk about. And I said, I want to talk about whether the United States should support Israel, only because to me, that's the number one political question, like the most important for Americans and for me. And I'd love to talk to actual Israelis about that question. And I have done that, about 10 years ago. I had a big argument with an Israeli in LA about this, but generally speaking, I don't have that kind of conversation. And I really want to hear from you about what's going on inside Israel, because I am not getting a lot of information about that. I'm getting some, and I've seen some reports, and you know what I do? I plug in Tel Aviv on Instagram as a location, and you can sort of see just the raw feed of everything coming on Instagram from Tel Aviv. And it's not what I expected. I was quite surprised. It is, anyone can do it right now. You will most likely see lots of people posing in their underwear or lying on the beach or singing a song or dancing in front of the camera, all this sort of social media stuff. Every once in a while, there'll be some political statement. But it looks to me like a country not at war. I'll tell you that. It looks like a country having a good time. Now, I know that's not entirely true for everyone. I know I've seen plenty of reports of the mood in Israel generally. And I certainly know that many, many people in Israel are very much, of course, deeply invested in the war and in prosecuting it. But I actually wanted to get a sense from you. How many people are in it, and how many people are sort of like, not really political?
Right. Yeah. So that's a great question. And, you know, Israel kind of has this mentality of, you know, life goes on. So every time there's a war, you kind of have 1 to 2 weeks where people kind of like hunker down and band together. But very quickly do we see like life goes on as usual. And we've almost gotten used to that. You know, every few years, there's some kind of escalation of violence. There's terror attacks. There's rocket fire. But life does go on. So we are seeing that too. And by the way, just to share a reflection, we saw the same thing during COVID. So during the first lockdown, everybody obeyed. Everybody stayed indoors. And then life went on. And to the point where once they tried to do a second lockdown, everybody disobeyed. Nobody followed the rules. They said, fuck it, we're done with this. And then nightclubs were like peak COVID. Nightclubs were filled. So it's very much the Israeli mentality. But right now, this time has been different. The energy is not the same. Things have not gone quite back. Like, you walk around Tel Aviv, there's posters of the hostages everywhere. There's daily protests in this one center of Tel Aviv where the families of those who have family members currently in Gaza.
Yeah. I just want to tell you, I just watched your live stream from the square.
You saw that?
Yeah, I watched the whole thing. It was great. Really great, by the way. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. So, whoever is interested, you could go check that out. I did a live stream from there today. So it's very more real this time. Also, we have 350,000 reservists, right? That's like, that's like 4% of the country is currently in reserves. Everybody has family or friends who are currently in the military. And you know, from the outside, it's like, And I mentioned this in the stream today, it's very hard to empathize with a foreign group of people, especially when you view them as the bad guys. and, you know,
Yeah.
You know, like we see it here. Nobody here is going to cry over the death of a Hamas member, although it's not like their family members, like their family members love them the same as we love our family members. So even, you know, us having, you know, 4% of the population reserves and our active military is currently in a position where they could be killed, that causes a sense of stress for almost all people. So it's definitely felt. People are out at cafes, but it's not the energy you would feel when you're in when you're normally in Tel Aviv. So we're definitely feeling it. So
first of all, let me get some info on you. I know a tiny bit about you, but you sound American. So what's the story?
Yeah, great question. And you know, I actually think this is cool because I feel like a lot of the viewers here don't even have this background. So I think this is gonna be helpful.
Let's do it.
I was born in New York. I lived in New Jersey until I was 18 when I moved to Israel at age 18 and joined the IDF. Now I had a transformation, you know. I come from like a family with deep Zionist roots. My family actually moved to the land in 1812, 150 years before.
What?
Yeah, before.
Really?
I'm technically 10th generation Israeli.
There were like 10,000 Jews in Palestine then. That's
I think it was. Yeah, I don't know the exact number, but I think it was closer to 60,000. But yeah, it was definitely
not in 1812. No,
well, you're a historian, you know better than me.
I just saw those numbers. Is actually the number of early 19th century was actually 7,000 at one point.
Okay.
So no, it was not over 10 that early. Okay.
Yeah, I just asked ChatGPT whenever I don't know something.
Yeah.
So I'm
just saying that's a real commitment though. That's a really deep Zionist commitment. I mean, that's predating Herzl. That's predating the Zionist movement. That's when, and also, you know, that's when, you know, who was mostly calling for Zionism at that point in the early 19th century was Christian evangelicals.
Interesting.
That's the look at the history of Zionism. It was mostly Christian evangelicals early in the 19th century before Herzl. So I'm curious what your family was talking to at that time.
So I'll give you background on my family. So that Zionist movement, that was like a prior Zionist movement, which wasn't secular, like Herzl's Zionist movement. It was a religious Zionist movement.
Right.
It was, there's a famous rabbi, he goes by, Hagaon Mivilna, and in English, that'd be the genius from Vilnius, Lithuania.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this dream of returning to the land, and he never made it, or at least they don't think he made it. There's some speculation, but they don't think he made it. But a lot of his disciples, after his death, immigrated to Palestine. And my great grandfather, 10 generations ago, was one of his most well-known disciples. The story, he's actually quite famous in Chabad. His name was Moshe Meislish. And we don't know if this is true, but the story goes was he was a spy. He was a spy for the Russian during the war with Napoleon. He was translating for Napoleon. He spoke 7 languages, but he was reporting back to the Russians. The Jewish community there felt like their lives would be better under Russian rule than under French rule, which unclear if that's true, but that was the stance they took. That was the stance they took. And then Napoleon saw that information was getting out. He came in and he accused my grandfather of being a spy. The French soldiers vouched for him. He said, no, he's one of us. We could trust him. Napoleon said, I'm going to feel your heartbeat. And if I feel the heartbeat of a revealed spy, I'm going to kill you. And he was calm and got to live and then moved to Israel, or at the time, Palestine, Ottoman Palestine at the time. Now, we don't know if this is true. This isn't written in the history books. But if you're of the sect of Chabad, you learn this story growing up. So when I tell them I'm a Meislish, which is my grandmother's maiden name, they try to get me married into the family. They all have a daughter. They want to. And then I jokingly tell them if I could follow in the footsteps of King Solomon and have 1,000 wives, then I would consider their offer. And then
me too. I would consider that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So
either that or convert to Islam. I don't know, one or the other. But so you did your birthright trip and all that. Tell me about you, why did you make this major decision? And I have friends, by the way, who did the same thing, who were Americans and did the Aliyah and have lived in Tel Aviv since. So I know people like that.
So growing up, you know, I would hear stories, the Zionist narrative, you know, and it was very much, you know, learning about her persecution around the world, about the horrors of the Holocaust, about our deep history in the land of Israel, and how we miraculously created the opportunity to return and successfully returned, but yet that we cannot live in peace because the Palestinians, no matter what, will not let us live in peace. And I was never taught to hate Palestinians. I was just taught that we need to defend ourselves against them, because if we don't, then we will be killed.
Were they, that sounds sort of like, were they presented almost like a force of nature? You know, like it was just this problem that was eternal and you just had to deal with it, but you didn't moralize about it necessarily. You didn't say, you know, the weather's terrible today. There's a hurricane that's going to kill all of us, but we have to take measures and it's not our friend either. Is that sort of the attitude for the Palestinians in your family?
Well, I think it was moralized. It was definitely, we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. You know, they definitely want to kill us, and they're, you know, if we don't, but it was just that is life, right? It wasn't even as if we know what the solution is. It's like, we just need to live by the sword, you know, and defend ourselves. Cause if we don't, we will be killed. And
well, wait, I want to continue on this. Was there, so the perceptions of Palestinians is what I'm curious about, because, you know what the charge is, right? That Israelis and Zionists have been trained to think of the Palestinians as lesser, as animals, or as not quite civilized, and therefore justifies all the things that have been done since the 1920s, et cetera. Yeah. But is that, I mean, you know, in other words, racism, is there, do you think there was any racism toward Arabs or Palestinians in your family?
There is without a doubt racism amongst Palestinians and Arabs in my family, not in my immediate family.
I mean, so
my
toward Palestinians, toward.
Yeah, said, yeah. Toward, yeah. 100%. 100%. Okay. More so in my extended family. I have a lot of religious family. Some are settlers. Definitely racism there. Generally speaking, though, the narrative is not Palestinians are lesser and we can do whatever we want to them. It's more so it's valuing our lives over the lives of our perceived enemy. Mm-hmm. And really most of the racism stems from fear, right? It's not, there are some families that I'm sure are teaching hate, but generally speaking, it's not hate. It's that we need to fear these people and we need to defend ourselves against them. But that fear over a lifetime manifests itself into all sorts of things, including hate, right? So it's not, I don't think that there's a teaching that there is an inferiority here. I think there is a teaching that they come from a more violent culture, right?
Yeah.
That they're of a culture that praises martyrdom and that is more likely to engage in violence. And, you know, the Palestinian resistance has been exceptionally violent, you know, and it's not that it's been, you know, if you look at other anti-colonial movements, most of them have had a much more robust nonviolent resistance movement in recent times. One that would be comparable would be Algeria, which also has
incredibly violent. That was even more violent than anything.
Right. Yeah. But that's what they say. That's just another un-Muslim state acting violently. But then if you look at like South Africa and India and the American Civil Rights Movement, you could point to all these ones that really liberated themselves through primarily nonviolence. And then the instances you have of violence generally come from these Middle Eastern or North African nations.
Right.
It just kind of reinforces this belief that we return to a land that is inhabited by people who praise martyrdom, are quick to act in violence, and not only violence against soldiers, but like primary targets have been civilians since the beginning, right? So this is very much, not only is it true, it's very much embedded into the narrative. And those ideas, you know, cause a not only fear, but get us to see the other as different. So for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking through that and the different, that's interesting. It's very interesting to hear what the arguments are among Zionists and Israelis, et cetera. I mean, South Africa, of course, the ANC was extremely violent and did all sorts of horrific things to many people. You know, same thing in Rhodesia. I mean, there are many, many African anti-colonial liberation movements, as they're called, that were like more violent than what happened on October 7th. I mean, clearly, like in Africa, there was much, much worse violence than October 7th.
I don't know the entire history of, but I know South Africa, for example, did have violence, but the primary means of resistance were like generally nonviolent ones. Like that was their primary means.
Yeah. I mean, there's also, you had Zach Foster on your show, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, Zach will lay out the whole history of nonviolent resistance by Palestinians, which is quite extensive. And his argument is that
I like Zach, but I do think he's very biased, and I've heard him break it down, and I'd be happy to have him on to talk through it. He goes through it, but it's still a sliver. And I'll tell you one way we could look at it.
Okay.
We could put a list of every activist or advocate for nonviolent resistance, and we could look at what portion of society supported them, and then we could look at all the violent actors and what portion of society supported them, and it's not even close. It's not even close. So there is this idea, and again, I don't want to necessarily call myself a moral relativist, but I've never been one to say because they have different morality, therefore anything we do against them is justified. So I don't even think this is an entirely helpful argument. I think it's helpful to understand it in terms of how we perceive one another. But like, for example, Sam Harris recently put out this 1 hour long thing talking about the difference in morality between Israelis and jihadis. And I think he makes a strong case, but that doesn't really lead us to a conclusion, right? Okay. So let's say we are in conflict with a population that supports violence more than we do, or the type of violence they support is different. I mean, we're definitely killing more of them, way more of them. But let's say we could say there's a moral difference that doesn't justify harming people.
Yeah.
Right? There's no right. So that
I hear you. No, I get you. You know, I like that. I admire that, your position. And I think I've heard you say that elsewhere too. So, but I'm still going back to this thing about this idea that Arabs are culturally more violent than other people. I don't buy it. Let me talk about another group of people who have killed far, 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 far more civilians and did so deliberately and knowingly than the PLO plus Hamas plus Hezbollah plus Islamic Jihad combined times 10, which would be Americans. So in 1898, we're just getting going here. You know, we went into the Philippines and used machine guns on villagers in every village on Mindanao and just slaughtered every Muslim we could find to take that island. World War I, famously, you know, strafing all sorts of people. World War II, and this is just Americans. We haven't even gotten to the British yet, who are even worse, arguably. But, you know, Dresden, which many people in the Israeli government have been saying, yes, if you did Dresden, we should be able to do Dresden to Gaza. Well, the thing is, the Geneva Conventions decided after the war, you can't do what Dresden was. That's not okay to bomb civilians. It's a funny thing to be referencing for Israeli government right now. 600,000-ish German civilians, you know, I mean, just on and on and on and on and on. And then the Japanese. The Japanese, people talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. No one knows. Very few people know this. The Japanese would have been thrilled if the United States had only dropped the atom bombs on Japan. The dropping of the atom bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima were fought with the end of a firebombing campaign of more than a year in which every single city in Japan, except for one, Kyoto, 31 cities. Gaza is like nothing compared to what Tokyo looked like. The American government dropped bomb after bomb after bomb 24/7 for about a year and killed way more people than Hamas could ever dream of doing. So, and then there's Korea, killed lots of, and then there's Vietnam. You know, the estimates are somewhere between. The only argument is whether it's 1 million civilians killed in Vietnam and Cambodia by Americans or 2 million. We all know this. So the idea that Arabs are more violent than other people, and when I'm just bringing up one example, which is the shining example. We're the good people, supposedly. The good people killed millions of civilians in just one century. But Arabs are actually inherently more violent is a strange one for me.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a good point. I'll try to point to a distinction that I think many would try to make. It's that. We could have a discussion of if there's actually a moral difference here.
I didn't even get to Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah. No.
It just goes on and on and on. How many civilians we've killed?
If we look at numbers, right? Yeah. Sheer numbers. The past few decades, the United States has killed by far the most people. The super civilized Western United States has killed the most children in the past few decades by significant margins, right?
Exactly.
I think the distinction people point to, it's that does the American populace rejoice when they see that civilians are killed? Like, do they cheer it? Do they see these people as heroes, or did they view?
No, I was going to say, yes, they did. I mean, look at John Dower's. Let me just tell you, I mean, during World War II, there was a whole consumer industry in which people were trading and selling and buying the skulls of Japanese civilians who were killed in the war. I mean, the GIs in the Pacific would send, or soldiers, whatever, Japanese skulls. They would send Japanese skulls back and they would sell them, and it was a big thing. No, it was a violently racist society, this was America during World War II. And then with the Germans, you know about the Germans. I mean, we had no problem killing hundreds of thousands of German civilians and celebrated it, of course, because it meant victory.
Right. So I do want to get back to the distinction. And again, I'm not even making the case that it makes much of a difference. It might show a difference in culture, but it might not show a difference in morality. So I think that you have when you have like a Western military, and we're seeing this right now in Gaza, when a Western military kills civilians, they view it as necessary collateral damage. And there's almost like a shallowness in how they view it, because they don't think it's almost as if any collateral damage is okay. There shouldn't be any expectation of some consideration of proportionality when a nation is at war. And I think this is where we're very unsophisticated with how we view things. So very much it's like, okay, 4,000 Gazan children have been killed. Well, Hamas shouldn't have attacked us. This is the consequence of war. Well, it's true we got attacked on October 7th, but that doesn't mean any response by default is justified, right? And this is where you and I are going to be in complete agreement. But so generally there's a distinction in how we view military action, like collateral damage as a result of military action, and then the intentional targeting of civilians and cheering that. And then in addition to that, everyday civilians getting involved in this killing. So one is almost like a more sophisticated murder. It's done by weapons. The people aren't getting involved, nor are they saying that civilians should be targeted. The other, it's more so everyday civilians are getting involved. So it creates this idea that the average Israeli is not going to harm a child. The average Palestinian might. Now, I would not make the case to say the average Palestinian would harm a child, but this is the distinction that it speaks to, not the harm that each side would support against each other. It's the ability for each side to be involved and get their hands bloody. And this is how they kind of put a distinction of culture. We don't want to get our hands bloody. We're not going to harm children. If children die along the way, fine.
Right.
The claim made about the other side is they have no problem just like killing women and children and cheering about it.
Yeah.
And I think that does point to a cultural difference without even trying to, like, you know, I think there's a difference there.
Yeah. I mean, the question is why is there a culture of death among Palestinians? Why are they called themselves? What do some of them call themselves? A nation of martyrs, right? Is that always been the case, or was maybe just since 1948? I think it's been since 1948.
Well, you know, without a doubt, people are products of their environment. So the Palestinian population is now the most radical they've ever been, and so is the Israeli population. That's not for a reason. If we look at polling, you have over 80% of Palestinians support some kind of Sharia, which is interesting because it's not a super religious community. This is a Pew poll from 2017. Okay, so it's like, okay, well, you know, Muslims, that's what they support. But then if you look at Kazakhstan, for example, it's only like 21%, right? So say what you want about Islam and you know, spread fear about what Islam means for people who subscribe to Islam. How do you have a difference in such a vast difference in public opinion, depending on the country you go to, right? Yeah. Palestinians also have some of the highest rate of anti-Semitic views. Well, no shit. They've been in conflict with Jews for 100 years, right? So clearly a lot of the views that the population has is dependent on the environment that they were raised in. I think that there is something that wasn't created by Zionism that we see in Middle Eastern culture. It's like a strong sense of honor, right? There's a very strong honor culture. So like, there's not many places in the world where you have like honor killings. And it's not common here, but there are, you know, in the Middle East, you have family members killing their daughters for shaming the family. You do have, this is an interesting distinction between different cultures. Some cultures you could make a yo mama joke and live. Other cultures you can't. Like if you make a yo mama joke to and this is only Palestinians, this is also there are Jewish Israelis, depending on where what their ethnic background is, that you cannot make a yo mama joke to, but that ends in violence, right? So there's definitely this strong sense of honor, and I think it does get in the way of solving the conflict to an extent, because many Palestinians are very zero sum. They're not going to accept any solution that has Israel remaining to exist. It's like there was an injustice and we need a complete removal of Israel for us to agree to anything and we'll continue fighting. I think a lot of that does stem from honor, but I do want to make it very clear, you know, because anytime there's a conversation about distinctions between culture, this is used to justify group hate and racism. And I think right now what we're doing is having an honest conversation about differences, but it's important to make clear this does not justify harm towards any group. And more than anything, people are products of their environment. So if anybody has a critique over Palestinian culture, or if you have a critique about Israeli culture, it's a question of what can we do to change the environmental conditions, to change cultures to be more oriented towards peace and more oriented to living side by side by one another. So I do want to make it clear, I'm happy to keep talking about cultural differences, and I'm happy to talk about Jews have very interesting, you know, cultural norms that other people don't have. I'm happy to talk about it, but we can't allow this to open the door to group generalizations and group hate, because so much evil in the world comes from doing just that.
Yeah, no, I want to. You pointed to something really interesting. The cultural differences, I think, is really important. And Sam Harris is pointing out what he thinks is a fundamental cultural difference between those crazy Arabs and us. And Sam, you may notice, I would ask you and every one of your listeners, listen to Sam Harris, and how many times, just in any 5-minute segment of his speech, he will use the term crazy or a synonym for crazy to describe the ideas he's arguing against. And that's fundamentally what Harris's argument always is. Muslims, radical feminists, the woke left, whoever it is he's angry at, they're crazy and deranged. The man is an intellectual charlatan and a fraud, and I'm happy to attack him whenever he opens his mouth. So the idea that Arabs are engage in a culture of death and martyrdom more, I guess, or unlike Westerners, is really, again, quite astonishing if you know just the most basic things about modern American history. I mean, during times of war, and this is the crucial thing, Sadar, right? During times of war for America, we act like goddamn savages. We become racist against the gooks in Vietnam, or the Japs in Japan, or the Huns in Germany, whoever we're slaughtering, right? We become complete animals. Right. Also, what happens with our sons? What do we think of our sons, our 18-year-old, 20-year-old, 22-year-old men during times of war in America, during times of war? My God, we are so proud of them. They are the nation's heroes. Mm-hmm. And when they die in combat, we don't say, oh my God, what a wasted life. No, we put them on a billboard. We erect huge memorials for them. We have national holidays for them that are eternal. We are a nation of martyrs too. I don't know what brother's talking about. I don't know which country he's looking at. Sam discovered politics on 9/12/2001 and didn't know anything about politics before then. He admits this. And that's the problem. He's fundamentally naive and doesn't know anything about history. And he also will never mention history, because that will refute all of his claims instantly, as I just did. Anyway, so the point there is that during a time of war, Americans act like the Palestinians in Gaza, because I believe the Palestinians in Gaza and in the West Bank and throughout Israel have been at war for at least 75 years, but I would argue for 100 years.
100 years, yeah.
And that is what it looks like. That's what people generally do, how they act, how they behave, how they think of the enemy, how they think of the other enemies, the enemy's civilians during a time of war. Those people were placed in war 100 years ago, and they've not been able to leave ever. And so this culture of death and culture of martyrs, which I've seen, I know it's true.
Yeah.
Has to me like flourished in exactly the kind of place you would expect it to flourish. And it's right. Where, and it looks no worse, no nastier, no more violent than America did in 1943. I promise you that.
So I'm going to even build on that point and show how quickly populations start to engage in group hate. COVID, increase of attacks against Chinese people increased because of Chinese Americans, right? We're being attacked because of the actions of a government on the other side of the world.
Because we thought we were at war with China. Some people did. Yeah.
And even if we were in direct military conflict with China, how does that reflect on the population? Right. It's very important to be able to make a distinction between populations and their governments. And, you know, people struggle to do this on both the Israeli Palestinian side. People will always accuse me of murdering children. Like, you're a child murderer because you're Israeli. It's like, how do you know what I actually believe? You know, how do you know if I support the actions of the government?
Let me pause there. This is a question. This is a really big question I wanted to ask you. So they would accuse you of that, I think, if they're at all intelligent. I mean, they would not make the accusation that you literally physically by your own hand killed someone. But I think, at least if they're sophisticated and intelligent about this, the argument anyway is the same argument that's been used about the people who lived in Sderot, right? And in this, which is that they are civilians, but simply by being Israelis on that land, they are settler colonizers and occupiers. So what do you do though then about the baby, the child born in, let's say it is a settler colony, Israel, right? Let's say it's a violent apartheid settler colony, which to me it just obviously is. We can talk about that, but I mean, just clear as day that it is. But then again, what do you do if that is true? If that's all true, what do you do with the people who were born there 10 years ago, 5 years ago, you know, the third or fourth generation of Israelis? And that's the hard part for me. And I have an idea. It'll never take root. I don't think it'll ever become popular. It certainly won't become policy, but my idea, the only, as an American, because I do feel I feel like the United States has some kind of obligation to the citizens of Israel, because we basically created that place since 1967. I mean, Israel wouldn't exist as it does without the United States since 1967. I think that's pretty clear. And so we America, more than anyone else, in some ways, even more than Israelis, by the way, are, I think, primarily responsible for the fact that there's a baby born into a settler colony right next door to the people that were displaced. You're giving birth to a child in a place of danger.
You feel this way about all of Israel, not just West Bank settlement.
I think so. I think it's, to me, again, going back to American history, I think the best analogy I feel about Israelis, all of them, including you, the way I would feel about settlers in what is now Arizona on Apache land in the 1870s, right? This is when Geronimo and the Apaches were just murdering all the settlers and going wild on them. But it was Apache land, and the settlers were violent too, and they took this land and they did so violently and they killed Indians to do it. It's very similar.
And then they
started to enclose them into reservations, and the Apaches kept violently doing nasty things. So if you're going to have a child right next to where Geronimo lives and you've displaced his people from his land, I mean, it'd be like moving to the worst neighborhood in the city and having a child there. You know, that's to me, and I don't know what to say about that, but that's what it is, except to say, you know, I wish you would live somewhere else because I like you and I care about you.
Yeah. So, well, I appreciate that, but I'll try to offer, a different perspective here. You know, almost all Israelis, put the West Bank aside because the contested territories, the majority of Israelis don't don't support settlement expansion and would happily have that. I mean, after October 7th, support for two states decreased significantly, but once we achieve relative quiet, you'll see support go up if there's some hope. Mm-hmm. But Israel proper is internationally recognized by the vast majority of the world. There's no reason for Israelis living there to think that that's not their legitimate land. It's the only home they've ever known. But, so to think that like they're somehow guilty of something besides wanting to live in the home, that, right? So it's like,
I'm not saying, I just want to be clear. I'm not saying that. Okay.
Right.
The original settlers. Yes. I mean, up through, well, I don't know, the '60s or seventies maybe, but not now, not people who were born since then. Of course not. Yeah.
So I think, you know, you mentioned settlers living in Arizona. I think the way we should view Israelis is not so different from how we should view Americans. Americans are living on stolen land. The difference is that you no longer have an active conflict in the
United States.
But the reason there's not an active conflict is because Americans were way more genocidal, and they genocided the Native Americans to a point where they don't pose the demographic control, so they could just leave them on their reservations. They could vote. They could vote, and their voting doesn't matter because they're such a small.
It doesn't really matter. I mean, I'm not at all denying genocide. It's more complicated than that, but it doesn't really matter to me how it was done. It's just the fact that it was done, that the Indians were defeated, and that there has not been any resistance to my existence on this land for about 150 years now. That's why. So it's not living in a bad neighborhood, and that's why I have always advocated, including for. I'm a quarter Jewish, and my Jewish family is from Odessa, which was Russia at the time during the pogroms. They made the decision in the 1880s not to follow Herzl to Palestine, but to go to Chicago. And no one in my family has ever been killed by an Arab. No one in my family has ever been afraid of being killed by an Arab. No one in my family has been forced to be in the military to protect an ethno state. you know, so it's to me that was the good decision made by Jews. And I'm really glad my family made that decision. And as Americans, as I said, who the government of America since 1967 has absolutely co-constituted Israel, no doubt about that. I do feel like I would not want to just, even though I'm an anti-Zionist, and I'll say that, I would not, that doesn't mean I want to just cut and run. I don't want to just say, well, good luck to you. You know, we're out of here. Have fun with the Palestinians. I think the only sane, moral, just thing for the United States to do is to transfer or to convert the $4 billion per year that we spend on Israel, we give to Israel, to a fund to help resettle Israeli citizens. It's going to be a reverse Aliyah, reverse Zionism. I don't know. That's to me, I think we have some obligation to Israeli citizens, but otherwise I want nothing to do with that project because I see it as, and I wrote an article for the Daily Beast about this 12 years ago, 14 years ago. It's bad for Jews. Like I never understood that sort of as a group. It's bad for Jews and it's clearly terrible for Palestinians. It's also really bad for world peace. Now we have what, 7 or 8 nations who are possibly going to war over this conflict. It's just been a 75-year catastrophe. Now I understand that life in Tel Aviv, and I see it on Instagram, and I've had friends, not just you, who live there, and I watch Fauda, and I watch the Israeli TV shows, and I get a sense. It's pretty fucking cool. Like, I often think, God, I'd like to live in Tel Aviv. It's got that, like, hippie, bohemian vibe, which I really love, and I'd love to hear more about that. I know very well there's a very strong tradition of Israeli Jewish peace activism, humanitarianism, solidarity with Palestinians, opposition to many aspects of Zionism. I get that. All of which is kind of like what I've seen in Tel Aviv, especially, and in Haifa, looks to me from the outside like a kind of place I'd want to live in. Definitely, except that it's a garrison state. And the reason that it is so nice and lovely to live there is because you've got an army all the way around it, and inside of it, everybody's basically militarized, as far as I can tell. And it's a militarized culture. And I think there is an Israeli personality, especially those who are born and raised there, that I've noticed that is quite militant and somewhat belligerent. And I don't judge that. I understand it. If you're born into a country in perpetual war, I would have that kind of personality too. So again, like, why would you want to live that way rather than in Chicago? You know, I mean, why not? Why there and not Brooklyn? You know, so, like
someone pointed out Chicago not being the best example because of the crime rates there. But that's besides the point. I do get
Jews, Jews have done great in Chicago. They've had no problems in Chicago.
we do quite well wherever we go until shit hits the fan. And then we're generally the first attacked. We've kind of been like this historical scapegoat. But I just want to back up a little bit because, you know. So there is a conversation of should Israel have been founded in the first place? And I think that, looking at how Israel was founded and the displacement that occurred even prior to 48 and the whole idea of building a Jewish state on land that was inhabited by other people, I think there's a very strong case to make that the way Israel was founded was unjustified, despite it being created by, call it an indigenous population returning, an oppressed population returning. None of that, you could still say none of that actually justifies the way Israel was founded. And I think we would probably be primarily in agreement there. Where I think we differ is now, given the fact that Israel exists, what do we do moving forward?
Right.
You know, you kind of said because the conflict in the United States is over, so Americans should stay. But all that really does is kind of support the idea that Israelis should just continue to brutalize Palestinians until there is no conflict, because that's what will give them the right to stay in the land. And I think that, could you imagine if there were still like a Native American tribe that did not accept the fact that the United States existed and they were determined to destroy the United States, mm-hmm. shoot rockets mm-hmm. on city centers and attack civilians? You mm-hmm. could very clearly see that, like, we should probably tell them that the United States isn't going anywhere, but if you struggle with the existence of the United States, it's probably better to work to transform the United States to be one that is more suitable to your liking rather than try to dismantle it. So this is kind of what I tell people. Many Israelis or many supporters of Israel want to pay for Palestinians to leave. You propose something similar for Jews to leave. I think it's important for us to ground our activism in reality and what's likely to happen. I have this idealist side in me, and I don't think Jews leaving the land is ideal. I think it would be, I don't think we create justice by creating another injustice, but I do, when I'm trying to see how the world should be, I have all these idealist ideas, but then I say, is it viable? How do we get there? So I really try to ground my activism in what can be done. Israel exists. Any attempt to dismantle it has just been met by force and mm-hmm. and has fueled the radicalization of the Israeli people, right? Like, Israelis say they want to remove us from the land or they want to kill us. This is how a lot of our militant policies are justified, by these ideas that Israel should be destroyed. If Western activists, instead of saying, I want to dismantle Israel, they're saying, no, we should transform Israel to be a nation that Palestinians can come to terms with, mm-hmm. Israelis would support that. So Israelis are actually very critical of their own government. We just had 8 months mm-hmm. of protests mm-hmm. Every week for 8 months, record levels of protests. Israelis are big on changing their government, but they're not going to fight. They're not going to rally to put themselves in danger. The dismantling of the state in Israel is seen by as most Jews as a call for their death. They don't see any way they could stay safe without the state of Israel on the land. And there's good reason for them to believe that. So they won't rally for their death, but they will rally to transform the country. So I think Western activists, Palestinians, and Jewish Israelis can work together to transform the state in order to be one that it's easier for Palestinians to accept. And you know, I think Palestinians need to work to really rise up and not only work to transform Israel, but to build themselves, you know, a beautiful state where they could self-determine how they want. So I think calls to remove one another just radicalizes us. It's not realistic, and it just pushes us farther away from each other rather than bring us together towards a shared future, which it seems like we're going to need to find a way to do regardless.
Yeah. I mean, that I think is essentially the argument that's been made by the Israeli left forever. Right. I mean, I think you sound like a peace now person basically in saying that, you know, essentially.
Yeah,
it's like,
I think peace now. Yeah. I don't agree with everything. Like, I don't think we must have it. They're big two-state solution people. I see other potential solutions other than two states, but I do think any Israeli that's more focused on peace than on militarism is commendable, and we need more of those. So yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that you're a two-stater, basically.
No. So I'd say that's where I differ from peace now, because there are two-staters. I could support a two-state, but I think a federation might be a more sophisticated solution, which is essentially one state, but it's one state that will allow for Palestinians to have justice and will still keep Jews safe.
I just saw that. Who is proposing that, the federation idea? It's interesting. I haven't read it yet, but I saw that.
There's a few people, but we had someone on our channel named Emmanuel Shachaf, who's one of the architects of that solution. So he was on last week. He breaks it down again. Like, how do we implement it? I'm not sure, but it seems like we need to start thinking in those terms. And the majority of both populations don't want to split the land. Palestinians want access to all parts of the land. Jews want to be able to access holy sites that are in the West Bank. So the federation kind of keeps it whole, but doesn't create a situation where you have two distinct populations who have different ideas for what it means to self-determine, who are culturally different, and who have been in conflict with one another for 100 years out of suddenly competing over the same government and control of the military. That would just end in disaster. Like the whole one state solution, as many people propose it, it's like, it's not going to work out in reality. But a federation with a sophisticated system of checks and balances.
All right.
Yeah. A Jewish government, that's cool. Government. So that's what I like. Yeah.
I want to really look into that. I'm curious about that. I just saw that for the first time the other day. But let's talk about this thing about the one state solution, which I don't think I have a position on that. I mean, I don't live there, so it's not really my decision anyway. But I do notice some interesting contradictions, some momentous contradictions that no one in the American establishment or the Israeli establishment has ever been able to explain to me, which is this. For 20 years-ish, we went to war around the world to spread democracy. Actually, I take that back. For 100 years, we've been going to war around the world to spread democracy, right? Democracy is so important to us as Americans. And this is one of the major reasons, supposedly, we've been supporting Israel, because it's a democratic nation. And we are democratic, and we want everyone to have democracy. We want everyone to have the vote wherever they're living in the world, right? Except for one people. The Palestinians. The Americans have said consistently, no, we want the Iraqis to have the vote. We want Afghanis to have the vote. We want Iranians eventually, after we invade their country, to have the vote. We want the Saudis to have the vote. We want everybody to have the vote except for those people, except for the Palestinians. They can't have the vote because when they use the vote, when they get the vote, they're going to use the vote to kill all the Jews. That's the whole argument. Am I wrong?
Are you talking about have the vote in the sense of making all Palestinian citizens of Israel and giving
one
them the
state.
Vote?
Yeah, state, one vote, yeah. One person for everyone who was originally, yes, right.
Yeah, yeah. Most people who are against having one state, one person, one vote are against it because they think it would lead to bloodshed unlike ever we've seen on this land. And right. it wouldn't be one-sided bloodshed there. It would lead to civil war, and we'd see, I don't even want to put a number to it, but it's, you have 50-50 population who have been in conflict with one another competing, yeah, over control of a government and military. It's not hard to see why that wouldn't end well. And there's been other conflicts that tried to have some binational system that ended violently. But yeah, yeah. And I don't think America cares about democracy. That's just the excuse they give. America wants to control their sphere of influence in the world. And yeah, if the pretense is spreading democracy, or if it's WMDs, they're going to use whatever justification they can to increase their sphere of influence. America doesn't really have their foreign policy isn't based on morality and values. It's interest, right? So I think we're probably in agreement.
Of course. No, I did. But one of the points I was making was how hypocritical the United States is about this. However, do you believe in democracy?
Do I think democracy is a, well, I like Winston Churchill. I like Winston Churchill's quote. It's the worst form of governance aside from all the others. So I think right now a democratic system is the best that we've come up with, but there are many flaws in democracy. And I think maybe in 100 years, we'll look back and kind of laugh at,
So this idea, though, and I have a whole separate critique of democracy we don't have to get into now. I'm actually not into democracy, but in this case, I think I am, because I get it, you get it, but they don't. Until we rectify that, I think we can't really have arguments.
But Palestinians do have had elections in their territory. So Israel proper, you have 20% of the population are Palestinian citizens of Israel, and they do have voting rights. Yep. They have voting rights. 50% of doctors and pharmacists in Israel are Palestinian citizens of Israel. They've served in government. They have a member in the Supreme Court. And, you know, this is many Israelis. They're like, what do you mean apartheid? Look, Palestinian citizens of Israel have all the same rights. People who are saying Israel is an apartheid state, they compare like the rights Jews have to Palestinians who are not citizens of Israel. And that is very apartheid-esque. Like, I think we would be in agreement there.
Well, just go to Hebron. I mean, just go to Hebron. Yeah, I mean, it looks just like South Africa. I mean, come on now.
Yeah. Exactly. So Palestinians, you know, they had an election in Gaza in 2006. They voted for Hamas, and Hamas hasn't held more elections since then. Mm-hmm. They voted for the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank around the same time, and the PA hasn't held elections since then. So Palestinians have had the opportunity for government, but for some reason, the governments they elect just have kind of canceled it out. So, you know, that it's not that, you know, most Jewish Israelis would say, yeah, sure, let them have democracy in their territory. Let them self-determine how they want. They won't say, give them full rights. Let them be citizens in this government, because why would we let an enemy population be a citizen? Like, it kind of poses an existential threat when a population that wants to destroy a country is part of that population. No right. country can survive having a 50% population that doesn't support the state. Right.
Right. So they're opponents of the Jewish state. Right. They want to annihilate completely the Jewish state. They want to drive into the sea the Jewish ethno state. So once that's removed, once it's now a one state democratic entity, it's no longer the Jewish state. So why would they have a reason to kill Jews at that point? Plus, they'd have a majority. So and also, we know the history of Palestine and the Arab world prior to Zionism. Generally speaking, people got along great, certainly a hell of a lot better than now. So the idea that you, even if you take away all of their grievances, which you would do, you would take away all of their grievances, which are legitimate, even according to a lot of Zionists, they're legitimate grievances. If you take away all of those by creating a new state that is not an ethno state, that is majority rule and democratic, I don't understand. You have to rely to the idea that Palestinians will then launch a set of pogroms against the Jews requires the belief that Palestinians are inherently anti-Semitic, inherently Jew-hating.
So I actually disagree. I don't think it means that they're inherently Jew-hating. I think that there is some amount of the population that their sense of justice is actually vengeance. And it's actually, if you talk to Palestinians, there's actually this great channel called the Ask Project. And again, this isn't official polling. It's anecdotal, because you'll just go to Palestinians on the street and Israelis and ask them certain questions. But I know the person who runs it. My son
is a big fan. He's always trying to get me to watch it.
Okay. Yeah. So I like, that's an awesome channel, because we don't know much about each other. And that's just a great way to get to know the views of Israelis and Palestinians more. Mm-hmm. And I was actually very sad watching one episode, and it was, should Jews remain on the land? And he was talking to them in Ramallah, which is actually more moderate than a lot of the other West Bank cities and villages. And almost all of them said they will need a leave. Mm-hmm. So it's not, I don't think it's realistic to think that it'll just be kumbaya. There's a strong sense of vengeance, and this is our land and they've caused us all this harm. We need to get them back. I don't think that will just disappear the day the state of Israel disappears. And if you speak to Palestinians, a lot of them aren't shy in their aspirations to rid the land of Jews. And even if we could point to pre-Zionism, where we had relative harmony, even though Jews were second-class citizens, there's no reason to think that after 100 years of conflict, with the amount of fear, mistrust, and hate, that we could just go back to pre-Zionism. I think we could get to this one-state solution the way you think of it after generations of reconciliation. I think we could set it as a goal to reach one day, but we need trust amongst one another, one another before we get there. Like, I'm not some fearmonger in any way, shape, or form. I have a lot of close Palestinian friends who I care about dearly, and I say with very high confidence that it would end in bloodshed.
Okay. Okay. So let me tell you about the other part of my family. So, you know, One grandfather born in the shtetl in Russia. My other part of my family was Scottish. The Scots, they were Scots Irish, and they colonized Northern Ireland infamously. And of course, for about 100 years or so, very similar, about 100 years, we know, utterly vicious violence by the colonized versus the colonizers, the indigenous Irish versus the Scottish and British colonizers, right? I mean, just grotesque stuff, blowing up whole hotels, killing civilians, killing children, killing women, killing all sorts of people, mostly civilians, in fact. Disgusting on both sides. Well, look what happens now. I mean, nowadays, there's Northern Ireland, and it's full of my people, you know, the Protestant, the Ulster Protestants who colonized the joint, and all the Catholic majority who were oppressed for centuries, and they all live there, and there's no more violence. And they've been doing this for about 20 years now. There's many, many, many examples of this around the world of people who fucking hate each other, suddenly finding a way to live together once the political issues are resolved, right? Once one side gets what it needs and the other side gets what it needs. So it's, again, I don't, you know, and then you could talk about like the United States of America. I mean,
well, there's a lot of examples also where it didn't work.
Like what?
Well, first of all, I think South Africa, as much as it was good to end apartheid, I don't think the situation in South Africa is good right now.
Yeah, true.
Right. I think also Kosovo, right? Was it? Well, again, right?
That's so, I mean, that is such an international conflict. It's hard to sort of isolate, you know what I mean? The ethnic conflict within it. I mean, you had the United States, Russia, multiple countries.
But I think a lot of it comes down to, if we want to see what will make it work, it's how similar are the populations culturally?
Yeah.
Like, can they speak the same language? Do they have the same religion? Do they have the same culture?
So the former Yugoslavia, not just Kosovo, but the entire area, the Balkans, right? Yeah, you had a Muslim population there that was at war with the non-Muslim population, and now they're not. I mean, and now it's not perfect, but they're coexisting. They're certainly not at war. And there's no Gaza Strip in Kosovo. There's no bombing of civilians. There's none of this nastiness that's going on in Israel and has since 1948. So I don't know. I don't buy it. And again, it requires a belief in sort of these inherent ethnic hatreds, right? And it's just been disproven over and over again. The history of the United States of America, you know America because you're also American. You know, I mean, look at us. I mean, my goodness, look at all the ethnic hatreds that we have dissolved. I mean, look at all the people who could be hating each other, who have hated each other in our very country, who live literally right next to each other. I mean, in my neighborhood, there's Cambodians here, and then there's Laotians there, and then there's Americans, and there's Black people, then there's Mexicans, each of whom have warred with each other, you know, against each other. So, and we're all cool in the same neighborhood. I don't know, man. I don't buy it. I mean, I get the fear. I do understand the fear. I do. I'm not saying it's irrational. I'm not saying it's crazy. I do understand it. I'm saying, though, that there's plenty of historical evidence to suggest that you shouldn't worry.
So I think there's a lot of examples where the conflict continues, but I think it's also important to understand that the nature of this conflict. We could talk about different ethnic groups in the United States, but Black Americans it was never part of their narrative to rid whites from the land, right? So it's not that was
the Indians. I mean, yeah,
right. But the solution to that was actually genociding them to a point where they were not a threat anymore, and that should not be the solution here. Right. Like we need to grapple with the fact that we're talking about 50-50. And when it's 50-50, you do have the ability for population to get vengeance in a way that's extremely harmful. So when you look at the nature of the conflict and you look at the, again, it's not even assuming anything about Palestinians. It's listening to them. Again, not all Palestinians, but if you speak to enough Palestinians and you ask them, once Palestine is liberated, should Jews remain on the land? It's not uncommon to say, no, they need to go. It's not uncommon to say, they could live here, but they need to live under us. It is uncommon to say we will all live together peacefully, kumbaya. That is a less common viewpoint than saying they need to leave or they need to be second class citizens.
So if I were that guy, but the question I would ask them is,
but why shouldn't we take what they're saying at face value? I don't think this has to do with ethnic hate. I think it's really just understanding the nature of the conflict. If you're at war with somebody for 100 years and you're always, you've constantly been on the worst side of it, there's such deep pain and trauma and fear and hate from Palestinians to Jews, to think that there isn't going to be some segment of the population that's going to see this as an opportunity for vengeance. I think it's not really grappling with you know, reality as it is. And more so, what makes Jews uncomfortable, it's not like there has ever been a large movement amongst Palestinian society that has been one to call out the violence. So it's not, Israelis don't trust that, even if some percent are violent, Palestinians will rise up and stop it, because we haven't seen that happen.
Right.
Even if the majority aren't violent, they're scared. So they kind of keep quiet. So I'm saying we take Palestinians what they say at face value. And again, I'm not saying all, I'm saying a significant amount. Are not shy in their aspiration to rid the land of Jews. So to think that they're just saying that for no reason, I tend to believe them.
Okay, those are all very fair points, but I think that the question that was asked of the Palestinians is the wrong question. So if you ask them right now, or 2 years ago, or a year ago, or 10 years ago, in the midst of all this, should we rid the land of the Jews? Yeah, of course they're going to say yes. I mean, because that Jews to them represent what? Do they represent me and my son in California who are Jews, or do they represent like the Zionists, the Israelis? The question I would ask them is, if we eliminated the Jewish state by transforming it into a democracy in which all people get a vote, would you still then want to drive the Jews into the sea? And are you suggesting that their answer would still be yes?
Yeah, I think a significant amount in all too large amount would still say yes, the majority of Palestinians don't support a binational state.
So
it's interesting. Why don't they? Right, the majority don't support a two-state solution, because that would be accepting Israel's right to exist. And I get it. I understand where the pain comes from. It's like, why should they accept an enemy state on their land? I understand where the energy behind denial of Israel's right to exist comes from. But again, I'm just trying to talk about reality as it is. The majority don't support a two-state solution, and the majority don't support a binational state. So what does the majority support? A Palestinian state where either Jews need to leave or they could live as guests. And this is the majority viewpoint. Now, does this need to be the majority viewpoint for eternity? No, we've been at war for 100 years. But to think that the day we dismantle the state of Israel and create a binational state, it'll be kumbaya without a reconciliation process that may take generations. I think we're, and even if I can't say 100% it would lead to violence, even if you could say it's 50% or even 20%, Jews aren't going to take that risk. They're not going to risk their genocide. They would rather continue to be in conflict. They'd rather be called racist. They'd rather be isolated than be dead. So right. I think there's ways we could move forward that will ensure Jewish security and ensure Palestinian justice. And I think, and if I am to simplify the conflict, it's find a way to ensure Jewish safety, ensure Palestinian justice, and that should be the framework for moving forward.
I agree with that very much. And I like, I fully endorse that particular framework. Those should be the objectives, right? Yeah. Jewish safety, Palestinian freedom. And what I'm arguing is that the latter is not necessarily a threat to the former. Palestinian freedom is not necessarily a threat to Jewish safety. That's what I'm attacking.
Yeah,
I think the belief that it is, and I'm not saying you're saying this, but the general belief that Palestinian freedom means Jewish death is racist. Because again, it depends on this idea of Palestinians being inherently violent, inherently a culture of death, etc. And Islam, right? I mean,
right.
You can make arguments, of course, that Islam promotes or encourages violence, you know, the call to jihad. I've taught the Quran. Yes, of course. And I actually like that in the Quran. And by the way, it's very similar to Jewish ideas about vengeance too. But you can also read it completely differently as a book of peace. And many people have read it that way. And of course, the vast majority of Muslims in the world, like more than a billion of them, are utterly peaceful. So I don't see it. I think if you take away all of their grievances that they have stated since 1948, since 1920s, eliminate all those grievances and they still act like maniacs, then sure, then we can go about killing them. Because then they really aren't human beings. They really are just savages, and there's really nothing to be done with them except murder them. And I would totally be fine with that. If a group of people were actually just fundamentally homicidal, then I'd want to bomb the fuck out of them. But that is so far from the case. So far from the case. If you know anything about Palestinians at all, you know how ridiculous that is. So,
well, you know, Palestinians are some of the most hospitable and warm people I've ever met.
I know. It's the most heartbreaking thing.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking thing. Yeah.
Even the other day, I shared this on the previous stream. You know, I was in Northern Israel, and Northern Israel is the greatest example of coexistence amongst
Haifa.
Even farther north, but Haifa and farther north, it's not coexistence to the fact where they're still like towns are primarily Jewish or primarily Palestinian. So you actually have this idea of separation side by side with coexistence, which again, I think works when there's different religions and cultures. We don't necessarily need to be in the same neighborhood. And let me just give you a clear example of what can go wrong. So there's some neighborhoods that have mixed populations. There was a Jewish girl. She was like tanning in her backyard, and the Palestinian neighbors had family members over, and they saw the girl tanning. They were furious by the idea that she was like in a bikini on her front yard. Like it was triggering to them. And you also have religious Jews.
Yeah, right.
And generally speaking, there's different neighborhoods for secular and Orthodox Jews. It's not forced, but it's a natural segregation based on culture. I think that's fine. I think people should be able to associate and live next to who they want, as long as it's not forced, like redlining in the United States. But I got my mom moved apartment, so I didn't know where she lived. My phone died while I was driving, so I couldn't find her. So I stopped at some restaurant, asked if I could use a charger. They're like, yeah, come on in. You know, let us bring you the charger. You want some coffee on the house? It was just such a beautiful and warm moment. You know, they're Palestinian citizens of Israel, so they live amongst Jews. But I've had similar experiences also with Palestinians who are not citizens of Israel. They are a very warm people. So I hear what you're saying. You're saying when you see that side of Palestinians, when you see how warm they are, how could those same people engage in violence against civilians? But I think that, you know,
well, it's not the same people. I mean, that's the first thing to say. They're not the same. They're not Hamas. They're not anybody. They're not terrorists. They're not even violent. They're not even.
On one hand, I think that's true. They're not the same people. But I think there's this interesting concept in human behavior that people struggle to grasp. It's how otherwise kind, compassionate people could hate somebody deemed their enemy. And I'll take the most extreme example, which might cause offense. Hitler was compassionate towards Germans. He genuinely cared about the German people. If he would see a German baby, he would feel that same warm, fuzzy feeling a regular person feels, unless he was a psychopath. But I don't actually think he was. Mm-hmm. It's just we love our in-group and our out-group. If they're deemed a threat, if they're not deemed a threat, maybe we're indifferent. But if they're deemed a threat, we'll support violence against them. I have cousins who are settlers. They're super kind. They hate Palestinians, not to the point where they're going to attack them. So I think this is something people struggle to grapple with. It's like you could be super kind and compassionate to people in your in-group and then be support something akin to evil towards those who you are in conflict with, you know?
Well, but except what you're saying is, I mean, and this is what I've heard many times is Palestinians are hospitable to non-Palestinians and even Jews.
Wait, one more time.
I thought we were talking about Palestinians being hospitable to the out-group, to being hospitable to Jews.
Yeah. But no, in this sense, that would be a segment of the Palestinian population that is not seeing Jews as the enemy, whether they're Palestinian citizens of Israel or they're peace oriented, Palestinians. But it's not like I could go to, I wouldn't be safe in many Palestinian neighborhoods in the West Bank.
Really? Is that really true?
Yeah. I mean, it's not.
Even if you're clearly not a settler.
Yeah. It's, I mean, if I'm not a settler, there's a view that all adults are IDF or ex-IDF.
Oh yeah.
It's true.
It is true. You are ex-IDF, right?
Well, exactly. but there's not much of a distinction there. It's like, I could be going to the West Bank for peace purposes and somebody might still see me as an enemy. And again, I've been to the West Bank. I just real quick. Years ago in 2016, I went to East Jerusalem and blindfolded myself with a sign. I'm a Jew and I love you. If you love me back, give me a hug. And people told me if I go, I'll be killed. Okay. They said, do not do that. I said, I'm doing it. We had a security guard who canceled on us that morning. So we didn't have security.
Wow.
In East Jerusalem. So that is a place where they are living together. There are Palestinian neighbors, but I got hugs in East Jerusalem and this video went mega viral, and it really, a lot of people reach out. They said, wow, that really gives me hope. It really shows me another side. So I think maybe in some instances, the level of fear we have of the other side is over exaggerated, but it doesn't even take the majority to want to harm the others if the majority won't stand against the violent minority.
Yeah. So I personally know, I think, half a dozen Jews, American Jews, full Jews, Americans, who have lived in the West Bank and in Gaza, I mean, for months or years, and including, you know, Amira Haas, right? The Haaretz writer, she lived in Gaza for years and wrote a book about it. But all the Jewish anti-Zionists have all spent time there that I've talked to, been on my show. And every single one of them not only reports no one attacking them, they also report the hospitality you've been talking about. Like they were brought into Palestinian families. And the most amazing, here's the best story. Yesterday I had Dan Cohen on. Do you know Dan Cohen?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's amazing. And did the documentary Killing Gaza with Max Blumenthal, right? two Jews who lived in Gaza. Hamas, when he was in Gaza in 2014 during the war, Hamas actually called him in and they brought him into their headquarters or whatever, because he had been telling people openly, like he and Max had been telling people openly that they were Jewish in Gaza. And then they get called into Hamas. He goes into the headquarters and sits down. The Hamas guy says, please stop saying that. We want you to take care of yourself. There are some people among us who actually are anti-Semitic.
They might
hurt you. The Hamas people wanted to take care of the Jewish guys. Now I know they understood, of course, that Max and Dan were, you know, helping their cause indirectly, not deliberately, but of course they were. But if they were so anti-Semitic that they just can't wait to kill Jews, why would they treat those Jewish guys in that way? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. There's this idea that, you know, many people say Hamas, they're anti-Semitic and they want to destroy all the Jews in the world. And there's no reason to believe that that's true. They have no reason to attack Jews indiscriminately around the world. But what we do see is people in support of Palestine are doing that, which is unjustified and B, all it.
Do we really see that? Who have we seen?
Every time there's some kind of escalation of violence between Israelis and Palestinians, you see anti-Semitic attacks increase in Western nations around the world.
I'm gonna challenge that.
you could look it up. I mean, it's.
Oh, I know. I know the numbers.
This is very much in line with what we said earlier. Like, if Chinese people are being attacked when COVID happened, and Russians are being attacked when war between Russia and Ukraine broke out, why wouldn't there be an increase in anti-Semitic attacks when Israel's bombing Palestinians? I mean, that's literally human nature. It's just
the reality. So this gets down to the, do you know Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro?
The name's familiar, but
I really encourage you to have him on your show. He's an Orthodox rabbi in Brooklyn, and he's been a rabbi for decades and is in his 70s, but he's an anti-Zionist. I almost said anti-Semite. He's an anti-Zionist. And he has an amazing argument. He's going to be on my show soon, about similar to the Haredi argument about Zionism, not just being not Jewish, but actually being anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic, in fact. And so the problem with Zionism, and one of the reasons I'm so angry about Zionism, my son is Jewish. My mother's Jewish. I guess technically I'm Jewish. I've been around Jews my entire life. I was married into a Jewish family. The thing that makes me so furious about Zionism is that they have placed targets on our backs, because they have said that they are doing all this in our name, for us, for Jews. And unfortunately, there are some people in the world who have believed them. They've believed them that, oh, Zionism is Jews and Jews is Zionism. Now, fortunately, I think, from what I can tell, from what I've seen living here for 58 years as a semi-Jew among Jews, paying attention to this issue, is that very few actually do that. Thank God, very few people do think that all Jews represent Israel and Israel represents all Jews. But yeah, during times when Israel is killing babies, there is an uptick in people who get angry at Jews. Now, I was at a march in San Francisco. It had 50,000 people at it. This is 2 weeks ago. A free Palestine, straight up, you know, what you expect march. And I swear to God, I promise everyone on earth, I saw not a shred of anything I would consider anti-Semitism. So, and these are people who hate Israel, boy. I mean, the people at those marches, we hate Israel. I mean, trust me, but no anti-Semitism. So
I don't deny that the majority of the anti-Israel movement, or what you'll see at these marches, is not how it's painted on by the pro-Israel movement on Twitter. Mm-hmm. But we, you know, Israel's actions fuels anti-Semitism globally.
Some, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Whether... And what's ironic about that is all that does is strengthen support for Zionism. It says, okay, well, if Jews are indiscriminately attacked, then we need a Jewish state. So
right.
I'm gonna tell anybody who thinks it's okay to attack Jews, on a moral level, you shouldn't. But purely on a practical level, if you want to achieve your goal of being an anti-Zionist, let Jews feel safe. Okay, so that's some practical and moral advice for those who want to.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, but
It's also just stupid. And I mean, so I'm just as mad at Zionists. They're equally guilty to me, although I'd say Zionists are more guilty. Zionists conflating Jews with Israel, and anti-Semites conflating Jews with Israel. It's stupid. It's wrong. I mean, there are rabbis all over the world who will spend days and days telling you exactly why that's complete nonsense. And in fact, that Zionism is anti-Semitic. And I think that's a good argument to make, by the way. But no, anyway. I hear you.
I do want to make one more point about the ultra Orthodox community that is anti-Zionist, because they may be a convenient ally, but if you actually look at their views, they support a Jewish state. They just don't support Zionism because of its secular nature. So their view is that we need to wait for the Messiah to return, and then the land will be given to the Jews, and it will be a Jewish theocratic state. So it's not like these people.
Doesn't matter. I don't care. Yeah. No, my point is, no, it's not that. Believe me, the ultra-Orthodox.
I'm saying, it's a convenient ally, but if you actually think what they believe, it's not. There's not an alignment in belief. You know,
I like almost nothing about, you know, Orthodox Jews. I want nothing to do with that world. However, my point is that there is a very powerful and I think persuasive argument, theological argument, that Israel is actually a renunciation of Judaism, but it is it's idolatrous. You're taught to worship the state instead of God. I mean, it's a very powerful argument that undercuts basically the entire Zionist project from the get-go. The idea that I can become, or my son can become, a citizen of Israel when we have never practiced any religion ever is just silly. But anyway,
well, but I you know. I don't see why that would be anti-Jewish. Like, is being a nationalist a form of idolatry? I'm not sure, you know. And Here's the thing: I'm in the camp. I've had debates on the show that anti-Zionism is not inherently anti-Semitic, right? Many Jews believe that. Many in the pro-Israel mm-hmm. camp believe that. So I don't think anti-Zionism is anti-Semitic, but I certainly don't think Zionism is either. I'm actually under the belief, and this has been my critique of many social justice movements. There's this strategy to broaden the term of the word to describe hate for your group, whether it's transphobic, racist, anti-Semitic. Broaden the term so it's hard for the regular individual to even understand what this term encompasses. Assume the worst about somebody's intention and label them this term without giving them the benefit of the doubt, trying to speak to them or trying to educate them. And what this does, and again, this happens with anti-Semitism. I've seen it happen with racism and transphobia. It dilutes the meaning of the term. It gets people to not take accusations of this seriously, and it pushes people away, right? If you're going to just label somebody anti-Semitic, that's more likely to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. I definitely want us to not be liberal in how we define people, giving them these categories of hate. So that's kind of how I view it.
Okay. All good, man. I should go in a few minutes, but I do want to, let's finish by answering the question of the stream. Let's go for that, because that is ultimately
we'll answer two audience questions and we'll prioritize. Sure. We'll prioritize super chats for whoever wants to support the show. So yeah, let's question of the stream,
which, you know, for Americans, I argue it's the only question. It's the most important question. It's also, I think, the most important question for Israel too, because if America no longer supports it, then exactly what will Israel look like? That's an interesting question, by the way. But so I want to know where you stand on this. Do you think that I should be, as an American, through my tax money, should be supporting Israel?
No, I don't actually care how people view it. Like, I want people to view this objectively. And if you view the conflict objectively, you take a step back, you should be extremely critical of Israel, right? So that's my position. So, I don't see why Americans should blindly support a state that they're extremely critical of. I think if Israel gets $4 billion a year in funding, it should not be unconditional. It should be conditional on Israel doing certain actions to bring us closer to peace. So I think that money should be used as leverage. And I also think that money, you know, many people think that money is just a result of like AIPAC and the pro-Israel lobby, but 70% of that money is spent on U.S. weapons companies. So it's really the main force behind U.S. getting that funding is A, to increase the sphere of influence around the world, but also it's a subsidy for American weapons companies. So it's the war profiteers who really have interest in that yep. coming. So I want there to be criticism of Israel, but I want that criticism to be in the form of transforming Israel and not dismantling it. I think that would be the healthiest stance to take.
Okay. Yeah, no, again, that sounds like a good old fashioned Israeli left wing position that I'm very sympathetic to. It's not my position. I have some criticisms of it, but I'm not hostile to it. I think it's a legitimate, rational, and I think humane and compassionate position to take. The thing is that the U.S. has been supporting Israel since 67, 50, what is that, 5 years? Almost exactly as old as I am. I was born in 65. We started supporting Israel in 67. So I grew up with the damn thing. It has produced nothing but bloodshed and chaos and terror for everybody. I see no, so long as, here's what it is, Adar, and you would agree with this, I'm sure. So long as the Palestinians resist, so long as they refuse to give up their land, this is going to happen. We're going to have Gazas. We're going to have West Banks. We're going to have bombings. We're going to have probably killings of civilians. We're going to probably have suicide bombers or the equivalent, more attacks on civilians. It's just going to continue. That's all it's been, because these people don't want to leave. Now, I, with my modern enlightenment American consciousness, if you placed me in Gaza, even if, you know, if you put my consciousness and then inside of Gaza, my thought would be to get the fuck out of there. Like, leave. I'm not a part of an honor culture. I have no connection to the land anywhere. I don't have that a part of my consciousness. So I would just leave. But those people, for whatever reason, never have, the majority of them. They want to stay there. And that's something I would like to honor. But anyway, so I don't see, until they give up or Israel gives up, any support to that project, to the Zionist project, to Israel, is just more killing and death and displacement and apartheid. I don't know.
You're on mute. I would actually agree for the most part. I think U.S. funding should be conditional to being, it should be involved in the peace process. It shouldn't just be to buy weapons and business as usual. The status quo is immoral and unsustainable and will always produce more violence. And the U.S. shouldn't blindly support the status quo. Right. So, yeah, I think we're in agreement. And I do want to, I think neither side needs to give up. I think both sides just need to compromise. So my advice to Palestinians and the pro-Palestinian movement would be start to come to terms with Israel existing. And my advice to Israelis and the pro-Israel cause would be start to transform Israel so it's easier for Palestinians to accept.
How about one last thing? I still want to talk to you about this. I've been just noodling around in my head recently. Not that I have any power or say, or no one should necessarily care what I think about this, but I've been thinking about what an actual solution, what would I propose if I were a negotiator in this particular current conflict with Gaza, not the whole thing, but can we do that? Can we just about some particular specific proposal? So, I mean, like,
I love solutions.
I know. Right. So this is what, I get a lot of questions about from people saying, well, what would you do if you were Netanyahu? What would you do if you were Biden? Okay. Now, of course, I have a radically different consciousness than both those guys. But if you put my brain inside of Benjamin Netanyahu's head, let's do this. Let's go through these and see how you react to this and how you think Israelis would react to this. So release all the Palestinian prisoners in exchange for the Israeli hostages in Gaza. Number one, because I think that's the top Hamas demand. I see zero reason to not do that. For even if there were no Israeli hostages, I would want to release probably. Oh, let me make this clear, though. I would say only release the Palestinian prisoners who have not been convicted of murder. Some of them have been convicted in a court, I think pretty legitimately, of murder. I have no doubt that many of them did commit murder of civilians, not of military, only of civilians. If you've committed murder you've been convicted in a court of murder of a civilian, you don't get to leave. But everyone else, and I think lots of them were never even tried. That's ridiculous. Those are hostages. Those need to be exchanged right now. Get the hostages back in exchange for those people who are also hostages. So that's number one. And to me, like, that Israelis would be opposed to that is interesting. Then the settlements have to go. I mean, that's so clear. Now, the problem is, I understand, they're built into the ground quite literally. Some of them look like cities now. How are you going to displace all those people? What is it, 600,000 now? Is it 600,000 settlers?
Yeah, something like that.
I mean, so that's a massive...
Right.
That's a massive displacement we got to do. But I'm sorry, everyone in the world basically agrees that that is not their land, that it's illegal. I mean, that is almost universal. I mean, outside of Likud, like, pretty much everyone in the world, including Americans, by the way, including presidents, yeah, including Obama, everyone agrees that those settlers have to fucking go.
Yeah.
They're also a bunch of fascists. But, besides that, they just it's just got to go. So that's a huge thing. That's a massive thing. And then you've got to free Gaza. I mean, I'm sorry. You just have to let the walls down. We don't imprison people anymore. We decided this a long time ago. We don't do this to people. And I really like that movement in humanity, not to put, populations inside in a concentration camp like that, like the Warsaw Ghetto. And I'm sorry to people who are going to say, well, Hamas is then going to attack us. You can't do this. But again, if you get rid of the settlements, if you release those hostages, the Palestinian prisoners, 1,000 of them, I think, or 5,000, it's in the thousands.
I think it's 6,000. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It depends on how you count it, but yeah, whatever. But if you release the ones who were not convicted of murder of civilians, I mean, and Hamas continues their attacks, then Hamas will then be shown to be simply an irrational anti-Semitic terrorist organization, period. Right. And we should go into, and by the way, why are we bombing civilians? Why are we bombing hospitals in Gaza when we know the leadership lives in Doha? And why isn't the amazing, stellar, legendary Israeli special forces units going into their fucking hotel, whatever, the Four Seasons hotel in Doha, and killing those cats? Like, why not that? Why are we not sending special forces into Gaza, into the tunnels? You know, would I be really mad about that? I'd be still probably opposed to it generally, but you can't get too mad about that if you're sending like army in to kill army. Which that would be, but of course they have no interest in killing Hamas. They're interested in exacting punishment. But anyway, so that's the basis for my proposal. If I were Netanyahu, that's what I would do. What do you think?
Yes. Yeah, so I'll touch on all those points. I haven't actually seen polling on what the public thinks about releasing all prisoners. The challenge is they've all been convicted, but they've gone to military court. It hasn't been a civil court. So, and they have like a 98% conviction rate. So it's not,
right.
you could bring to question the legitimacy of that. There are certainly, without a doubt, some amount, I don't know what percentage, do have blood on their hands, have been involved in murdering civilians.
Sure.
But I think if you exclude the ones with blood on their hands, the majority of the Israeli population, I believe, would support that exchange. I personally would actually support releasing all of them.
Wow.
Which is a radical position. I would try to negotiate some middle ground, but I think if it comes to saving the lives of these 240 hostages, and the idea isn't even to release them back to Gaza, it's to send them elsewhere in the Middle East. That's what they're asking for. So I think I would actually support doing that, because I think in a sense, there an injustice is caused by releasing. Like if somebody harmed your family and they're released from prison, there is an injustice caused there. But that isn't a greater injustice than having your family member who's currently held captive, dying or remaining captive for their life. So I just think releasing the hostages should be our number one priority. I don't think the majority of Israelis would agree to release all for all, but I personally would be okay with that. When it comes to settlements, I actually think the majority of Israelis would be okay dismantling settlements if it actually came with a solution. They don't trust that would happen, because we did that in Gaza and it didn't work out. And I'll touch, we made some mistakes there, but we did uproot our citizen from Gaza, and then Hamas was elected and, you know, rocket fire started or continued. But I think that if you look at least two-state solutions, there's some land swaps. So the majority of the 600,000 live in actually certain three centers that are now cities. And I think you can make that Israel proper, and the amount you would need to uproot would be significantly less, probably a few tens of thousands. But I could also see a situation where they could remain to live there, because whether it's a federation or it's Palestine, there shouldn't be any issue with Jews living in Palestine. The problem is that in order for those Jews to live there and be safe, it requires a security presence, and that security presence is inherently oppressive to Palestinians. But if we could have a situation where they live there in a way that doesn't cause a loss of freedom for Palestinians, I think that should be fine. The same way 20% of Israel's population are Palestinian, let 20% of Palestine's population be Jewish, right? I think it's okay if we live in each other's nations. And if we have a federation, I think it's okay as well, as long as it doesn't come at the expense of Palestinian freedom. So we need to find a way that the military apparatus is not just securing Jews, but it's securing both Palestinians and Jews, and they both can see this military presence as a protector, rather one seeing it as a protector, the other seeing it as an oppressor. When it comes to like what happened in Gaza, right? We disengaged. It was very unpopular. Well, it wasn't unpopular. There was a great debate amongst, you know,
It was intense.
It was very intense. And you know, it was like, this is a new leaf. You know, let's see. Let's let Gaza thrive. And then Hamas was elected. And here's where Israel, I believe, made a mistake. You know, Hamas is seen as this terror organization. So we saw a terror organization is elected. We are not going to work with them. There will now be a siege on Gaza. The rationale behind the siege was, why would we let a terror organization import whatever weapons they want so they could fight us? We're not going to allow that. So we're going to control their borders, and we're going to let them, we're just going to not let them build the military to strike us. And just an example, like if we ever have war with Hezbollah, their rocket launching capabilities is significantly is greater than Hamas's. And the difference is Lebanon doesn't have a siege and Hamas doesn't. So we see the result of a siege just allows, you know, organizations to gain greater military strength. So this was the rationale.
Yeah.
But I think that we should have taken an opportunity and seen it. Okay, they were elected. Let's see if there's a way to work with them. And this is very unpopular amongst Israelis, especially after October 7th. After October 7th, what I'm saying is a radical position. But it would be better to attempt to work with Hamas back in 2006. And they reached out I wouldn't say they reached out an olive branch, but they did try to work with Israel, and we outright just rejected. We said there's not going to be, you know, you're a terror organization. There's going to be a siege. There won't be peace with you. And here I'm saying we should have attempted this. There is no guarantee it would have succeeded. Even if you look at their charter, which is their new charter in 2017, which is way more progressive than their previous charter, it still talks about the destruction of the state of Israel. So I'm not saying this would have worked, but I think there would have been a lot more justification for a siege if there was at least an attempt to normalize relations instead of just putting a siege on them the second they were elected. And I think that was a big mistake. And us doing that, we cannot legitimately say we tried, right? So we say we pulled their citizens out and look what happened, but when Egypt put a siege on Israel, we attacked them, right? So we view a siege as an act of war. So that's an act of war against Gaza. So we didn't really try to the extent we should have, and I think it was a great mistake. So yeah, that's kind of my thoughts on that. But I think everything you suggested can be done, but I don't think everything can be done as a precondition. I think we need to accept that whatever the solution will be is going to be a process. Peace unfortunately takes time, and the oppressed ones don't have the luxury of time. You know, it's easy for me, where the status quo is relatively comfortable, to say it's going to take time. Somebody who waits at a checkpoint every day doesn't like hearing that, but I really don't see any way to do this overnight. So I'm, again, trying to ground this in pragmatism and reality.
Yeah. Okay. It's good, man. I you've got a good heart, and it's good to hear from you. I'm wondering if the fact that you didn't live there until you're 18 accounts for at least some of your differences with other Israelis. Is that fair?
It's hard to say, because some of the most radical voices I hear are American Jews, or like a lot of the settlers are American.
Yeah. I noticed.
What
do you think of those people, especially the Americans who go there and then take Palestinian land? Is just like,
well, you know, if God says it's okay, how can you argue against that?
Right. And then that's their argument, is just some biblical stuff. Those are some of the worst people I think on earth. I don't know.
But here's the thing. If you actually they're going to have that hospitality and compassion to people who are Jewish or people they see as their friends, you know?
Yeah. No.
My cousins who are settlers are really some of the kindest people I know. Like my aunt, she had nine children. And then after she had nine children, she adopted a 10th with Down syndrome. Like, how can you view that as anything other than like a person with a good heart who just wants to help? And she does not like Palestinians at all, right? So it's complicated, but certainly my upbringing affected how I view things. But I would probably attribute it more to taking psychedelics than growing up in the United States. Like that'll open your mind and give you a different perspective on things.
Nice, yeah, And there's a big, isn't there like a big drug, in a good way, drug scene in Israel? It always seems like there's a big like Molly scene and a big weed scene and like.
I'm happy to end this on something lighthearted, but
yes.
And again, I do want to say that I don't think psychedelics on its own will solve the conflict, but it generally does. People who take psychedelics have like insight and are open-minded
People who smoke weed are compassionate. I absolutely believe that. Right.
Yep. Maybe sometimes lazy, but compassionate.
Yes, exactly.
I'll sometimes notice, like for me, cannabis use is habit forming. So I try to control it to just like once or twice a month. And sometimes I'm successful. Other times I slip up and I get high every day, but it's the most impactful for me when I use it sparingly. And I do notice that sometimes I'll reflect on some topic, some interpersonal issue, and I'm able to see it in like a much more compassionate and sensitive light. I'm like, oh yeah, this is this is good stuff, you know. Thank God for cannabis. So yeah, I'm trying to show you something. I'm gonna show it here. Actually, I wonder if I could do a screen share. That'd actually be cool. So there is a big drug culture here. It's not druggy like in the United States. Like you don't have nearly as many addicts or alcoholics.
Yeah, it's a good scene. I think
it's a way more responsible use. But here, I'm going to share my screen real quick. Am I going to get anybody arrested? No, this is all.
Again, every time I see like Israeli TV shows, I'm like very attracted to the way you all live. There's a lifestyle that is very
attractive. Yeah, there's something.
It's like California hippie bohemian. Is that, I mean, it seems like that's sort of the basic.
Israel, we're so binary minded, so it's hard to comprehend, but Israel is a beautiful country that I love, and it's an ugly country that I sometimes despise, right? So it's like both I hold both those true. Like there's so much about Israel that I struggle with and cannot take pride in and would do anything to see change. But then there's so much that it's like, My friends here, my family, there's a culture here, innovation, both medical and technological. How can you hate it, right? So
yeah, and that's the problem. That's the problem, is you can't just uproot that. You can't just, you know, even if you have the most perfect anti-Zionist argument, what does that mean? 8 million people just have to go and the whole civilization they've built over 75 years has to go?
There's clearly a better way, right? So
I get it.
So I'm going to share something on my screen like, this is showing how the markets provide and technological innovation, but to get drugs in Israel now is relatively easy. So they have these Telegram groups and so they'll just have a menu and you see there's like different types of mushrooms they have here. They have different types of ecstasy pills, MDMA.
Beautiful.
2CB. You have DMT here, different types of acid, speed, just the full menu. you tell them what you want and they have other ones for weed. That's like for drugs, but they have other ones for weed that you tell them what you want and you need to go through a verification process. So you need to send them like an ID, social media, and like you saying today's date or something. Mm-hmm. That way you're not an undercover because, you know, they're not, an undercover is not going to show their ID and verify every time. And then you don't even meet the dealer that's dropped off in a taxi, or sometimes they'll put it somewhere and send you a photo near mm-hmm. your address. So they have this very sophisticated way to get people whatever they want. And wow.
Well, let me tell you something. I really want to do this. I've been wanting to go to Israel and Palestine for a long time. I'm really kind of committed to it. I want to figure out a way to get over there. So when I do, you and I are going to go get high.
Yeah, well, I'd love to, and I'd love to show you around. And I want to put a disclaimer because I know we have a lot of viewers who maybe aren't into drugs or are more conservative. Drug use is a personal decision. It comes with risks. It's harmed a lot of lives, but it is also, in the right dose and the right substances, can be immensely beneficial to one's consciousness. So, like all things, drug use is nuanced. Do your own research, take your own risks, and reach out if you have any questions. I'd be happy to talk to you about it. And for the record, you know, I have no problem sharing. You know, I have a past of a fair bit of substance abuse. You know, I used to be a drinker. I quit alcohol for four and a half years ago.
Me too. Me too.
No alcohol for years. I quit almost all the hard drugs. Sometimes, you know, I'll take psychedelics in nature with friends, or I'll take Molly a few times a year. And then cannabis is the one I need to be careful of because it's habit forming for me. But, you know, I've definitely moderated my use, but I've tried most of them, and some I wish I took less of in my younger years. But all in all, I feel like getting to shift your mindset gives you a different perspective on life, and it helps you grow in many ways. So
absolutely. Well, awesome, man. Thank you for this. This has been great. I really...
Yeah, this was great. I'd love to have you back on. You know, maybe sure. We bring you on for like a group discussion or even a discussion with somebody else. So, thank you so much.
Would love that. Thank you, Adar.
Awesome. Peace.